We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both formerly with Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning to you.
All right. Lots to cover on this new year.
Yeah, we've gotten past the holiday lull, and it's suddenly busy again.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Which is good for us. All right, and hopefully good for people listening. Let's begin with some new candidates throwing their hats in the ring for city council.
Yeah, we knew this was going to happen, and of course a number of people had announced already because of Charter Amendment 19, which passed 2 years ago and created seven districts and two at-large positions for city council instead of the nine at-large that we've had before. All of the council members are up for re-election this year, all nine seats, and also because of the districts, which makes it possible for people to doorbell in a district. It creates at least the perception that people with not as much money can have a fighting chance of winning in these races. And so you're going to see almost, if not all, of the nine positions having primary battles as opposed to incumbents running either unopposed or functionally unopposed because they don't have credible opposition. There's going to be a lot more people running this year. We'd already seen a number of people announced in 2014, and it's gotten a lot more active now that we're in the year of the actual election in 2015. The most notable one this week was Shama Sawant getting some opposition in District Number 3, which is the Capitol Hill and Madrona-Leschi district east of downtown. Now, Sawant, according to poll late last year, had by far the highest favorability rating of any of the incumbent council members. It was over 60%. Nobody else on council, I think Nick Licata was second at 50%, and then most of the others were in the 40s. And of course, she's also the best known and probably has the highest negatives as well. Because she is the one council member who is not a member of the Democratic Party, the Democrat, because she's an open socialist and a member of Socialist Alternative, the Democrats have been trying pretty much since the day she was elected to recruit somebody to run against her this year who would attract a lot of support and have a lot of name recognition. And a lot of names have been floating out there and a lot of people have expressed interest. Allison Holcomb from ACLU was talking much of last year, as she was briefly in 2013, about running for that seat. She decided not to. She took a national position with ACLU instead. And a number of other names, particularly state legislative members, have been talking about running also. None of them have. A lot of them have been scared off by the fact that Sawant has both high favorability ratings and because of the races that she and her colleague Jess Speer have run the last 3 years. Probably the best turnout machine and volunteer base of any active politician in the city of Seattle. It's a pretty formidable thing to run against, even though she has a lot of mainstream opposition. So the Democrats finally did recruit somebody to run against her, but it's not nearly as strong a candidate as a number of the names that had been floated last year. It's a guy named Rod Hearn, who does not have much of a civic resume. Probably the most notable thing is that he has worked on a campaign for Ed Murray in the past, is fairly close to Murray politically, and has a lot of roots in the LGBTQ community. He is himself gay. He's also very wealthy. He has a mansion on Capitol Hill and can probably recruit, raise rather, quite a bit of money from his friends. But it's also a setup for Sawant's rhetoric, because she's talking about essentially class warfare as the basis of a lot of her policies, then running against somebody who is himself very wealthy and represents wealthy interests is sort of in her wheelhouse. So we're going to see a very clear contrast there. Now, Hearn himself, in announcing for the race and that he'd be running against Sawant, is talking about, well, yeah, she's done some good things on council and he agrees with some of her policies, but he finds her to be a very divisive voice on council. And, of course, that's going to play right into her rhetoric as well. So it's going to be a very interesting, if very contentious, race for that position in number three. We also have people who have been talking this week about running for the at-large positions, which so far don't have a lot of opposition. Tim Burgess and Sally Clark are the two council members who have announced as running for those. The other districts almost all have multiple people running for them now. So it's going to be very interesting to see how that develops over the course of the year. But Sawant was really the last one to not have any major opposition at all, and that now is filled in as well. And there may be more running against her as well.
All right. Also out this week, a study about the costs of the death penalty in the state.
Yeah, the Seattle University released a study this week for professors who looked at, they reviewed 147 aggravated first-degree murder cases filed in Washington State since 1997. And they concluded that on average, when the prosecution pursues the death penalty, it adds about $1 million to the cost of prosecuting a murder case. Now, the average cost per case when seeking the death penalty was about $3 million versus $2 million for a case that seeks life in prison instead. But, of course, the costs are rising, as the study's authors pointed out, that three current death penalty cases in King County have together cost about $15 million so far and are still not concluded. Nor does seeking the death penalty really save on incarceration costs, if you think about it, since many, many people actually stay for years, if not for most of their life, on death row, going through another very long and expensive appeals process, which again adds more money to death penalty cases, which weren't part of this study. And if you look at here in the state of Washington, Governor Inslee, the moment he took office, put a moratorium on the death penalty. So there are several people sitting on death row here in the state of Washington. So again, death penalty cases don't necessarily save on incarceration costs.
Yeah, and it's particularly notable because Washington State executes very few people. Even when there's not a moratorium, I think either none or very few people, maybe one or two in the last 20 years, have been executed when they didn't waive all of their appeals and literally want to die. Mm-hmm. So there's this fallacy out there that, well, because we execute very few people, it can't cost much money. And this study gets to the heart of the notion that the real cost isn't in the executions themselves. It's in how all capital cases are handled at the trial level, and then the very lengthy appeals process that follows, an average, I believe, of about 20 years.
Yeah, and I just want to point out that this is taxpayer money they're looking at. This is the prosecution costs, not the defense costs.
Yeah, and again, if you're talking about a state that has had chronic and severe budget issues, then
it makes a difference.
Eliminating death penalty, not just in terms of a moratorium on implementing it, but on pursuing it at the prosecution level as well would save an enormous amount of money that could then go into other programs.
Mm-hmm. All right. A couple polls out this week.
Yeah, two polls. The first one on voters' priorities for the state legislature. In other words, asking voters, what do you think is the most important thing that the state legislature should be focusing on during this upcoming legislative session, which is going to start on Monday. The voters' priorities were pretty interesting this year because in the past 7 years, voters have always said that the top priority is the economy. And that makes sense since the economic downturn in 2007. Now, in this year, however, it flipped. The top priority was public education. 42% of respondents said that funding public education was the top priority. Now, of course, their number two topic was the economy. 32% put that as their most important still, and that's about a good one-third of respondents saying that the economy is still important, which points out that even if public education is now on people's minds and the economy not so much, the economy is on enough people's minds that it really points out that it hasn't been a strong recovery at all. Number three on the list was budget and taxes. About 19% put that as their top priority. And number four was transportation at 17%. So I think that's kind of interesting. It's actually encouraging for Inslee, this poll, because 70% of respondents said that they support an increase in cigarette taxes, and 71% said that they would support a new carbon-based tax on industries that produce a lot of CO2. 57% said that they also would support in a capital gains tax on profits that people make on selling stock or other investments over $25,000 for an individual person or over $50,000 for a couple. That's good news because those are main platforms in Governor Inslee's proposed budget for tax increases. to increase cigarette taxes, to implement a carbon-based tax on industries that heavily produce CO2, and a capital gains tax. And the fact that those got outright majorities from people who haven't really heard much in the news about these types of taxes, that's good news for him.
Yeah, and the rhetoric that's coming out ahead of the legislative session on Monday from Republican leaders, particularly in the Senate, which is controlled by the Republican Party this time around, and Democrats, the battle lines are pretty clear around Governor Inslee's budget. And Republicans are making a lot of rhetoric also about funneling money into education, because, of course, the entire state legislature is under a contempt of court order from the state Supreme Court because they haven't implemented the McCleary decision sufficiently. But the tack that's being taken by Republican leaders, quite aside from the fact that their budget proposals would not fully fund the McCleary decision, basically they want to take the money and put it into education from other social programs, from other things in the budget, without raising taxes at all. And that simply, the math on that simply does not work, which Inslee has made a very strong case for. So we're going to see the battle lines drawn over, yes, education is fine, but the battle is going to be over how to fund it and whether to fund it adequately or not, because it's going to take an awful lot of money. And there are
it's
a number of other programs.
Increase,
it's going to take tax increase. There are also a number of other programs that have been cut dramatically over the past decade or so that need more funding now that the state is getting more revenue from a slowly recovering economy. And those are going to be battle lines also in the new legislative session.
Now, speaking of a different budgetary battle that's coming up in the legislature, transportation has its own budget that the state legislature hasn't been able to pass for the last 2 years. This is year three without a transportation budget bill passing. And the Democrats and Republicans have both said that they're going to work hard on it. We'll see. Now, the second poll I want to talk about is an Elway poll on transportation, asking voters what kind of tax increase do you think would work for transportation. 47% favored an increase in taxes for transportation versus 45% who did not want a tax increase. So it's about even there. Now, if you look at the margin of error, usually is about 2 to 3%. So it's about half of voters said yes, let's increase taxes for transportation, and half said no. Now, among those who are okay with a tax increase, 70% would support carbon tax for transportation versus 28% against. So that's also good news for Governor Inslee, since that was a big piece in his proposed transportation budget, was to take some of those carbon taxes and use them for transportation, since transportation is the big emitter of carbon in the state of Washington, is the transportation industry itself. Now, 53% of voters said that they would support giving local governments the ability to raise fees, including raising car tab fees. That's a slim majority there. But 55% said that they were against the miles traveled tax, which has been proposed by the State Transportation Board to replace the gas tax. And 62% said that they were against a gas tax increase altogether, which is how we currently fund transportation. So that shows you where the voters are headed.
Yeah, and the gas tax opposition is, even though the cost of gas itself has gone down quite a bit in the last several months, and people are spending a lot less on it now.
Yeah, and I think that makes consumers happy, having a little bit extra in your pocket to spend on other things besides gas, because, you know, heaven knows there's plenty of other bills to pay.
Food, rent.
Yeah, your credit card debt.
All right, moving on to national. The Congress was back in session this week.
Yeah, the House this week passed two bills that almost certainly will be vetoed by President Obama. The first one is the Keystone XL pipeline bill, which went through really quickly in the House. Although, you know, that bill, the Keystone XL pipeline, even though Obama may veto it this time around for procedural reasons, you know, he doesn't want Congress telling him you have to build this pipeline. He would rather preserve the president's authority to approve or reject the Keystone pipeline on his own. He may eventually approve it anyway. And so I think it's very important that people contact the White House and express your opinion about the fact that environmentally we can't afford to have something like the Keystone XL pipeline built.
That needs to be rejected on its merits, not just on procedural
grounds. Rejected on its merits, not just because you want to preserve the authority to approve or disapprove it yourself. Now, the second bill that the House passed was an effort to redefine what a full-time worker is under the Affordable Care Act. Currently, the Affordable Care Act, better known as Obamacare, defines a full-time worker as anyone who works over 30 hours per week. And in which case, employers who employ more than 50 people who work at least 30 hours per week would have to provide all of those employees, those full-time workers, access to health insurance. Now, if they redefine full-time worker to 40 hours per week, which is what the bill that the House just passed, that means anybody who makes less than 40 hours per week an employer does not have to provide them with access to health insurance. Now, this is kind of interesting because looking at it from the perspective of the employer, it's really easy to cut a worker who makes, say, it's really hard to take a worker who makes, like I do, who works, say, 35 to 36 hours a week, like I do. It's really hard to take me and say, okay, I'm reducing your hours to 29. That's a lot of hours you have to schedule to somebody else or hire somebody else to fill, you know, another 6 hours, 7 hours, 8 hours per week, another full day a week. Whereas somebody who makes 40 hours, it's really easy to go to them and say, okay, your schedule's now 38 hours a week. That's only 2 hours you have to allocate to somebody else. And there, as people know, working in modern American workplaces, there are plenty of people who work 40 hours who wouldn't mind working 42 or 44 or 45. So it's easier to reallocate a couple of hours than it is 6 or 7 or 8 hours. So what this does, in essence, is it takes a whole lot of people who make just under full time for various reasons, a lot of them disabled workers who can't physically work 40 hours per week. It takes them and it dumps them off health insurance and puts them into the marketplace where they have to buy their own and potentially buy it at subsidized rates. And that means taxpayers have to foot the bill rather than employers. And so this is a very, very bad bill. And the White House has said that Obama will veto it. And he should. Now, also this week, House Republicans voted and passed another bill is to change how the Congressional Budget Office evaluates the costs of legislation to use dynamic scoring. Now think for a second on what those words mean, dynamic scoring. It means scoring or evaluating the bill not to any particular defined standard or base, but to kind of use a fuzzy method to figure out what the economic impact of a particular bill is. So what it does is it allows whoever is running the Congressional Budget Office to use macroeconomics instead of microeconomics. So in the past, the Congressional Budget Office would take a piece of legislation and say, what's its impact on the federal budget? That's pretty simple. You know what the federal budget is. You know what the parameters of the bill are. You go out to the economy and you say, okay, this is a bill on a transportation budget. Let's look at what it means for transportation. Let's look at what it means for the federal budget, et cetera, et cetera. But if you're taking a bill and saying, you know, you can use dynamic scoring, then they can go out and use macroeconomic terms and say, okay, this could have an effect over the entire economy, you know, to boost the entire economy or not. And what it really does is it allows the Congressional Budget Office to define what economic impact is, to choose what sectors of the economy to look at or not look at. And that is setting up the Congressional Budget Office to look at the entire budget bill and say, well, tax cuts are great for the economy, when in fact there's no hard data out there. There are no hard studies that have said that tax cuts really benefit the economy. If there were a study like that, we'd be hearing about it from the Republicans probably every day, if not every, you know, every time they sit down to make a speech.
In fact, there's plenty of evidence to the opposite, that tax cuts don't stimulate the economy the way Republicans claim that they do. And really what this is all about is Republicans have been very frustrated with the Congressional Budget Office for a number of years because the Congressional Budget Office is nonpartisan. And what they want the CBO to do is to say that tax cuts work when, in fact, there's no data that they do. And they want to base their estimates on trickle-down economics and this idea that if you cut revenues, it will magically increase revenues. And the idea that it's magical means that the Congressional Budget Office, which tends to in the past to have relied on, you know, facts, doesn't take that claim seriously. And the Republicans want them to. It's a very politically motivated change.
Microeconomics, you can define things pretty well, and it's a little bit closer to science. When you use macroeconomics, it's much more like an art form than it is like real science. And that's the direction that the Republicans want to go. They want it to be an art form where they can come up with the data that they need to pass a tax cut or a budget bill that has their priorities in it, rather than to get real hard data that's meaningful.
Hence the term voodoo economics.
Yeah.
All right. I was surprised to see this week that President Obama is proposing a couple of years of free community college.
Yeah. I think the main question is, will Congress fund it? Because the Obama plan calls for the federal government to fund 75% of it and the states to fund 25% of it. So, of course, the two big questions are, not only will Congress pass a bill that will fund this, but will states get on board and also fund it? And we saw with the Affordable Care Act, we've seen with the new EPA rulings on greenhouse gas emissions for power plants, that there are a number of states who are going to dig in their heels and refuse to go along. That said, I'd like to say that it would be great if the federal and state governments would directly fund free community college rather than funding it through tuition credits. It would be great if the federal government would acknowledge that basic education now requires people to have at least 2 years of college in order to get even a modestly paying job in our economy, and that we make it not just K-12 funded by the government, but K-12 plus two.
Yeah, and I don't sense that there's a lot of support in Republican circles for education in general. But we'll see if they come through on this or not.
All right. Moving on to international, starting with the murders in Paris.
Yeah, there's been, American media has been dominated this week by coverage of not just the Charlie Hebdo killings in France, but a number of subsequent terrorists. And terrorist defiant acts. And unfortunately, what's been very interesting about coverage, especially in the United States as opposed to international media, is the lack of context and the lack of coverage of some other things. Reporters with and the Charlie Hebdo killings were in fact horrific, particularly for the political targeting of journalists. But Reporters Without Borders in 2014 reported 96 different journalists killed on the job last year in different parts of the world. That context got almost no mention in U.S. media, particularly because of those 96 killings, a strong majority of them came in countries that are allies of the United States. Specifically, the largest number of them outside were places like Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia, Mexico showed up on the list.
Journalists covering the U.S. war on terror.
Yeah, the Ukraine, which is again a U.S. allied government. So a lot of this violence came in countries where the U.S. has a lot of influence on what the government does, and they came from either the government or groups allied with the government. For instance, the killings in Mexico that have happened over the past year, but that part somehow is missing from a lot of U.S. media coverage of this, which tends to strictly define terrorism as something that's done by Islamic militants. The other thing that was very notable, even for terrorist acts committed by Islamic militants, is there was a much larger terrorism act this past week that got almost no U.S. media attention, that in Nigeria, where the very bloody Islamic group called Boko Haram, which people may remember from the kidnapping of a couple of hundred schoolgirls last spring, girls who have not yet been found or recovered by either the Nigerian government or international forces who have helped to look for them. Boko Haram now controls most of northeast Nigeria, particularly the province of Borno. There was one town in Borno that had held out for several months from control by Boko Haram, and that town called Baga. It was overrun last weekend by Boko Haram, and a number of reports have come out that the town literally was destroyed and almost all of its inhabitants killed, those who could not flee. At least 2,000 people were killed in that attack, and the details that have been emerging of how they were killed and the literal bloodbath that was involved, very, very sobering. And we've heard almost nothing about it in U.S. media over the past week, which is focused on a much smaller death toll in France. And, you know, you have to believe that the primary reason for that is that France is a white European country and Nigeria is a sub-Saharan African country, where we routinely don't hear about killings, even when they happen as a direct result of U.S. policy. In this case, Boko Haram, similar to the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, Boko Haram now has geographic control over a fairly large area and is now starting to spill over into neighboring countries, not just Nigeria, but particularly Cameroon, also Chad. And those countries also are being sucked into what is rapidly becoming a regional war. Boko Haram, in many ways, is even a bloodier group than the Islamic State is. And very, very concerning that that kind of violence is going on there. And the government of Nigeria, in particular, which is both very corrupt and whose military is strangely incapable of mounting any kind of attack against Boko Haram, in part because it's been infiltrated by a number of Boko Haram sympathizers. The U.S. gives a lot of aid to Nigeria, and its economy is dominated by Western oil companies. It's also the most populous country in Africa. So for a number of geopolitical reasons, very important to the West, and of course, in terms of the raw death toll, very sobering as well. But we're simply not hearing about that situation in Western media, and it's very concerning.
All right. Gives us about a minute to talk about Sudan and the International Criminal Court.
Yeah, the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, Fatou Bensouda, announced that she had decided to suspend the genocide case against Sudan's president, Omar Hassan al-Bashir, because world powers have done nothing to secure his arrest over the past couple of years since that indictment went down. Meanwhile, the United Nations this week also decided to further shrink its peacekeeping force in Darfur, which is already cut from only 20,000 troops to 16,000, even though the Sudanese government in 2014 killed more people there than it had had in any other year in the past decade. So once again, a sub-Saharan country where a number of things are pointing toward greater bloodshed, greater death toll of the civilian population, but it's getting very little attention and very little direct political action from Western governments or Western media.
All right. Events?
We've got a number of events coming up this week, starting today, where there are a couple of different protests around police accountability and the Black Lives Matter movement. At 12 o'clock, there will be one at 2200 Martin Luther King Way South. I believe that's the MLK Park at the I-90 LID. And then at 3 o'clock at Seattle Central Community College, Broadway and Pine. Also, on Monday at 9:30, the Seattle City Council is going to review...
9:30 a.m.
The Seattle City Council will review the SPD's response to Black Lives Matter and Ferguson and Eric Garner protests. And there's going to be an attempt to have a number of activists present at that to both testify and to pressure the city council for greater accountability on SPD.
And Monday evening at 7:30, there will be a play, Hands Up, Six Playwrights, Six Testaments, at the UW Jones Playhouse at 4045 University Way Northeast, sponsored by the Hansberry Project in the UW School of Drama, with a post-play discussion. On Tuesday from 5:30 to 7 p.m. at the Federal Building at 2nd and Marion is a rally to reject the Keystone XL pipeline. Send your notice to President Obama that you want him to reject it outright on its merits. And on Thursday, at 7 p.m. at UW's Kane Hall, room 110, is a movie, Pay to Play, Democracy's High Stakes on the Influence of Money in Politics. There was also an event on Wednesday.
That also at Kane Hall, room 210. There's an event at 5:30 p.m., so a little bit earlier, a panel on putting a price on climate pollution, and that's going to be
in the state of Washington.
That's a very good looking panel. That'll be at 5:30 on Wednesday night, Kane Hall, room 210.
All right.